Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We're starting in the Hollywood section. We're going to get to a few of those men from the Hollywood issue last week and check in on the royals and, of course, finish with politics. Our first headline is Macaulay Culkin still has actual scars from Home Alone 35 years later. The actor shared a new name and an old scar. This is by Marita Alonso on November 26th. It's been 35 years since the release of Home Alone, the film that launched Macaulay Culkin to fame. During a nostalgic night with Macaulay Culkin, a live event in Long Beach, California on November 22nd, commemorating the milestone anniversary, the actor explained that his full legal name is now actually Macaulay Culkin. He made the change in 2019 after conducting a poll of his social media followers to let them decide what his middle name should be. If someone comes up to me at the airport and asks, "Excuse me, are you Macaulay Culkin?" I can say, "Well, Macaulay Culkin is my middle name. I did it all for that one joke," he explained. Other suggestions included Kieran, a tribute to younger brother Kieran Culkin, and "The McRib is Back." At the event, he revealed another anecdote. To this day, he has a scar from filming the movie, courtesy of co-star Joe Pesci. "He bit me during rehearsal. The thing you have to remember is I'm not really on screen with Joe and Dan for a lot of the movie. They're off doing everything. I was just talking to the ether, so I didn't know him all that well," he commented. "This is one of the last days of filming, and I'm hung up there, so vulnerable," he laughed, recalling the scene where his character, Kevin McAllister, is caught by the wet bandits and dangling from a coat hook. And Pesci goes to Dan, "Dan, you want to run lines?" So he even asked me, and I was like, "Yeah, sure," because I don't have any lines in that scene. He said, "I'm going to bite these fingers off one at a time," and then he sank his teeth into my finger. I was like, "Ah!" You should have seen his face, because he knew he bit a nine-year-old. "A nine-year-old co-worker," Culkin said. Pesci, he said, apologized. "I was like, oh yeah, just don't do it again," he recalled of his reaction. "So yeah, it actually left a mark. It's 35 years later and I still have this little divot right here. This is Joey Baby's tooth. Not the gold one, the regular one. He gave me a souvenir. It's a nice story to regale you guys with. It's worth it now, but back then it was just like, who is this creep?" The actor explained that he holds no grudges against Pesci, though he did say he's contemplated taking revenge now, decades later. "He plays golf with a neighbor of mine, and he was always talking, 'Joey's coming over,'" Culkin said. "I'm like, yeah, yeah, you guys should come over. Ring my doorbell. It'll be fine. I want my kids to set up traps for him," he explained. "They're only really into that. You ever show kids this movie? Next thing you know, the next month, all they do is set traps for you. I get reported back to me all the time. My kids are starting to do that now, too." We're going to move into the Hollywood issue now. That headline last time was "Let's Hear It for the Boys." There were about 9 men featured on the Hollywood issue's front page. So we're going to start with movies are Glenn Powell's love language. The Texas-born and bred actor is grabbing Hollywood by the horns, starring in and writing hit movies at a breakneck speed. "There's not one part of me that's jaded," he tells Vanity Fair. This is by Daniela Tijerna. There's an old saying in Glenn Powell's family, a Texas-ism that cautions against ego. "Don't dance before you get in the end zone." Years ago, Powell finally attained the career success that had long eluded him, but still, "I do not feel like I'm in the end zone," he tells me, his fluffy pup Brisket lying in his lap. "To keep playing the game is where I live. As soon as you feel like you've made it, that's sort of the beginning of the end." Powell is one of Hollywood's most bankable leading men, having embodied charming alphas in box office hits like Anyone But You and Twisters, while proving his screenwriting chops with Hitman, co-written with Richard Linklater. He checked off the classic remake bingo box with The Running Man, which hits theaters earlier this month. When prompted, Paul can rattle off the pivotal moments that fueled his star's momentum, starting with a breakthrough 2-day role on NCIS in 2012. But per his family's mantra, the very polite Southern gentleman is still hesitant to deem himself a success. "I've had these little victories over the course of my career that have taught me different lessons," he says. It's ironic, then, that the Hulu series, Chad Powers, which Powell co-wrote, executive produced, and stars in, is about a cocky college quarterback who quite literally dances before touching down in the end zone, leading to viral fame and public shame. The series, loosely based on Eli Manning's ESPN Plus show, Eli's Places, tracks an absurd Mrs. Doubtfire meets Animal House comeback plot. "There's not one part of me that's jaded," he says. "I'm really pinching myself every day that I've stumbled into this moment where I get to do this." That characterization is a typical Powell understatement. As a teenager, he landed a small part in a long-fingered boy in a big movie, Robert Rodriguez's Spy Kids 3. I shot for a couple hours, maybe, and they had to literally kick me off set when the grips were moving all their stuff out. "I didn't want to leave," he remembers. Soon thereafter, Powell got to work in his family's garage, building his own makeshift studio. "I got PVC pipe and an old skateboard wheels, and I literally made my own camera dolly so that I could shoot movies with my friends." It's clear that beneath Powell's charming smile is an unstoppable grind. His hustle has taken him far. "When I first moved out to Los Angeles, if I would get an audition or a meeting on the Universal lot, I was that guy that maybe the meeting was 30 minutes to an hour. I would stay there all day," he says. "I didn't want to leave. I would go around the lot and try to meet people, go explore the lot. I'd go eat food from the Desperate Housewives' crafty craft services. I just wanted to be a part of that world." Now his production company, Barnstorm, has a bungalow on that same lot thanks to a deal with the studio. This, Powell knows, is his real superpower. "The reality is I've never considered myself to be the most talented person," he says. "I never felt like I was the guy that showed up and could nail it, but I knew that I was always the guy that was going to outwork the person next to me, and no one would ever outwork me." With a whopping 5 projects lined up, it's hard to disagree. He's currently working on a comedy about a country music star with Judd Apatow, something Powell can hardly believe when he says it out loud. His genuine "aw shucks" enthusiasm might be why the internet, which has affectionately compared him to a capybara, though Powell self-identifies as a golden retriever, loves to root for him. When he mentions A-list names like Tom Cruise, a guy that I really modeled so much of my taste and choices after, throughout our conversation, he always seems sincerely awestruck. He's just as excited to be there, on a film set, on a red carpet, or in a movie theater, as we are to see him. And he's more happy to pay that feeling forward. If somebody wants a selfie and they're like, "Hey, my mom's over there. She's embarrassed to talk to you. Can you go say hi?" I will walk across that restaurant. "I'll go say hi to your mom. I'll make a birthday video for whoever," he says. "That's what I'm here for. It's such a small amount of steps for me to make a real difference in someone's day, and I'm more than happy to do that." If you do stop Powell on the street or in a restaurant, however, here's a hot tip. He'd much rather talk about movies. "You'll never see me more excited. I leave a movie theater and I want to talk to everybody about the movie," he says with such conviction, it's hard not to believe him. That's my love language. Despite being one of the biggest names in Hollywood, Powell recently moved back home to Austin, where the rest of his family still lives. "I needed a spiritual place where I could hang my hat and truly be unplugged," he says. "If you live in LA, where everyone is sort of a part of this thing, you can never sign off of that app." Austin already offers sizable tax incentives to film productions, and Powell aims to make the state's entertainment industry even bigger. "All my friends know I'm starting to recruit all my favorite people down to Austin. There's so much being shot around Texas now, and it's about to get even more competitive." Powell's home state is also where, if you can believe it, he is slowly inching toward completing his bachelor's degree at the University of Texas at Austin. "I literally just paid my tuition 2 days ago for the next semester," he says with a laugh, aware of how absurdly full his plate is. He knows his hot streak won't last indefinitely. "Anyone who believes that they're going to be top dog forever has not studied how Hollywood works," he says. "So the best you can do is work really hard as you possibly can. Make things that you believe in, treat people well, and hope that you leave the world with some classic things that they can continue watching for years to come. I hope I get to do this job until I die," he says with utter sincerity, before pausing to clarify, "which I hope is at an old age, fingers crossed. I love this job." Our next Hollywood man is Michael B. Jordan, is a modern movie star with an old soul. The Sinners star shares his secret trick for tapping into his dual leading roles in the surprise hit vampire flick, the nature of his working relationship with Ryan Coogler, and his millennial-coded aversion to social media. This is by Chris Murphy. "You ever been to Cluck You Chicken?" asks Michael B. Jordan. He's en route to Vanity Fair's Hollywood issue shoot in London, but he can't help salivate over his favorite wing shop spot when I mention I'm from South Orange, New Jersey. A stone's throw from Newark, where Jordan grew up. "I haven't been there in so long," he says wistfully. "That's my spot." Alluring as the shop's spicy wings may be, Jordan is simply too in demand as one of Hollywood's last true blue, old-school leading men. As a young actor, he worked his way up the Hollywood ladder, delivering standout supporting performances on the soaps like All My Children and prestige dramas like The Wire and Friday Night Lights. He officially entered the pantheon of movie stars with the 2013 drama Fruitvale Station, his first collaboration with Ryan Coogler, the Martin Scorsese to Jordan's Robert De Niro. The two have since enjoyed one of Hollywood's most powerful partnerships, working together on the Creed franchise, the Black Panther films, and most recently, this spring's surprise smash hit vampire movie, Sinners. Coog, as Jordan affectionately calls him, has always been a trailblazer. Sometimes directors like to throw their weight around, not Coog. "We're always in lockstep and understanding what the shared vision of success looks like," says Jordan. "But despite their record of critically acclaimed box office hits, we've been underestimated," he adds. "It's always been an uphill battle to prove certain things. Not that we ever tried to prove anything. We always wanted to focus on the work and let those things speak for themselves." While Jordan loves being a vessel for Coogler's vision, he also picked up the directing bug himself since helming the third installment of the Creed franchise. This proved to be an asset on the set of Sinners, where Jordan says he got to be an extra set of eyes for Coogler. "Now you have two directors on set that are problem-solving and being creative," Jordan says. When challenged with differentiating the identical twins he portrayed on screen, the taciturn Smoke and hustler Stack, Jordan came up with an idea. "I wore different size shoes. As Smoke, he'd wear a larger pair. Smoke was really grounded and didn't really move around much. Stack was a little more adventurous and curious," Jordan says. "He was always moving from one thing to the next, a little lighter on his feet." The attention to detail and willingness to go the extra mile have made Jordan one of the last remaining stars who can reliably open a film. Perhaps it also helps that he had the good luck, or misfortune, depending on your point of view, of establishing himself right before social media became a deciding factor for casting directors. "Man, I'm born in 87," he says with a weary laugh. "I'm this bridge between knowing what it was like without social media, but then also understanding the impact that it has today." Jordan doesn't have Snapchat or TikTok, striving to be present for his fans without constantly putting on a show for them. "There's a balance I'm always trying to find, just trying to be genuinely me," he says. "I'm not going to act in all the elements of my life. That's the day job, you know?" To be a leading man in 2025, an actor must be dependable, says Jordan, who has spoken in the past of his admiration for colleagues Denzel Washington and Chadwick Boseman, as well as Tom Cruise and Leonardo DiCaprio. "There's a certain level of consistency that you have to have," he continues. "Some of the more solid careers that you look at have been the ones that have a strong foundation and have been cured over time and fortified." Although he's not heavy online, Jordan is not unaware of what the masses are saying about him. "I think people are still surprised that I like anime, which is pretty wild," he says. His love of shows like Dragon Ball Z and Naruto Shippuden is well documented and even influenced Creed 3. "At this point, I feel like everybody should know that I'm a total nerd when it comes to animation," he says. "It had such an impact on my childhood and my life today." Jordan's preferred method of communication is a good old-fashioned group chat. "It's always good to pop back into a group chat and catch up on what's been said," he says. "You get a chance to scroll back and say, what's been going on here? And then you realize you were a topic of discussion for a whole 2 days. They were roasting your ass," he chuckles, remembering times when he was the butt of the joke, but maintains that the chats keep him grounded. From a guy who's always on the go or out of the country somewhere on set, it's a good way to connect with my people back home, back in Jersey, back everywhere. These days, he's reading those texts from the set of his reimagining of The Thomas Crown Affair, which Jordan is directing and starring in for Amazon MGM Studios. Thanks to this recent Louvre heist, the project suddenly feels more relevant than ever. But for Jordan, this film has been a long time coming. The 1990s version, starring Pierce Brosnan, was a childhood favorite. Jordan has been developing his own take for more than a decade. Soon he'll head to Italy, where the team hopes to wrap shooting before Thanksgiving. It's a tough process, but moments that I've imagined in my head for a decade are now being brought to life with a cast that I'm extremely happy to have and really proud of, he says. I'm living a dream, honestly. And once he's wrapped, Jordan knows exactly where he's headed. Cluck you chicken. As soon as I get back to the East Coast, man, now that we're talking about it, I'm going to have to go pull up, he says, excited. I have to go get it. Next up, there's a for sale sign. Paramount, Netflix, or Comcast. Insiders debate potential Warner Brothers Discovery buyers. Each has pros and cons, but the bottom line may be that there are no perfect options. I just wonder, when has a Warner Brothers merger gone well, says one top movie producer. It's hard to even know who's the best. It feels like it shouldn't be happening. This is by Rebecca Ford on November 26th. I feel so sad, says one studio executive. They're not alone. All of Hollywood is currently bracing to hear which of three media corporations will change the landscape of movies and television forever. On Thursday, November 20th, Paramount, Netflix, and Comcast each submitted a bid to acquire Warner Brothers Discovery, the company that owns the Warner Brothers Film Studio, HBO, and cable networks CNN, TNN, TNT, and Discovery, among others. Each of the three companies comes into the potential deal with different ambitions. Paramount Skydance, which was created from an $8 billion merger by David Ellison earlier this year, wants to acquire all of Warner Brothers' Discovery assets, while streaming giant Netflix and Comcast, NBC Universal's corporate parent, have bid only for the company's studio and streaming business. The swallowing up of another legacy Hollywood studio, just a few years after Disney bought the entertainment assets of 21st Century Fox in a $71.3 billion deal, feels like yet another seismic shift for an industry that has recently faced setback after setback. It's not just Warner Brothers Theatrical, which is a mainstream studio, and all the IP that goes with it. It's also HBO. They're both these storied homes, the exec says. I don't see a path where those things still exist with any of these buyers, because I think they just get folded into the existing structures, even if that isn't the intention going in. Employees working under the Warner Brothers Discovery umbrella, who are still recovering from Warner Media's merger with Discovery, which happened less than 4 years ago, are battling anxiety about more upheaval and jobs that will likely be eliminated. There's a lot of tenured employees at Warner Brothers that have been there for 20 and 30 years, a Warner Brothers insider says. This is not their first rodeo, but I think ultimately everyone recognizes that this is different, that consolidation is happening, and it's a little scary. Insiders beyond those employed by Warner are also concerned about what the sale will mean for the industry's greater infrastructure, and as of right now, there are more questions than answers. Warner Brothers has been at the red-hot center as this constant target, and I just wonder, when has a Warner Brothers merger gone well, says one top movie producer. It's hard to even know who's the best. It feels like it shouldn't be happening. Many believe the best buyer would be the one that keeps Warner Brothers' theatrical output mostly intact, though it's not clear which of the three bidders fits that bill. We just don't know yet, one top manager says. It all depends on what they're going to allow output-wise. In August, Warner Brothers Discovery stated that its goal was to have a 12 to 14 theatrical releases per year. If the new buyer were to cut that output by half or more, it would be devastating for the market. Warner is on a generational run this year, thanks to hits like Sinners, Weapons, and One Battle After Another, and you don't want to lose that, the manager says. You don't want to lose the leaders there that are willing to take shots on directors and stars that want to go after original thought. If history repeats itself, though, that theatrical output will sink. Before the 2019 acquisition by Disney, Fox would typically release between 12 and 17 films per year. In its new form, 20th Century has so far released just 3 theatrical films in 2025, including Predator, Badlands, and Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere. 2 more are on the way in December. After the Disney-Fox deal, some of Fox's brands continued to exist under Disney's oversight, like FX, whose adult fare stands in stark contrast to the material that Disney's TV division creates, and Searchlight Pictures, Fox's adult specialty film label. But at least one unit that Disney had initially signaled would remain intact was eventually cut. Anytime somebody comes in and says, "We're going to keep these units standalone," you suddenly see things like 6 months later, "Fox 2000 is gone," the producer says. The insiders agree that Netflix and Comcast are more known entities at this point. The biggest question mark is Paramount, which has been crafting a new identity since the Ellison takeover. There's something about Paramount buying Warner that just feels more interesting. Maybe because nobody's been really able to see what they're going to do, an agent says. David is a film guy. There's something about a studio being run by somebody who loves movies and has built their own career from movies that makes you feel like there's potentially a good outcome there. Ellison also has the deep pockets of his billionaire father, Larry Ellison, backing his venture, which some view as a plus. "The thing about them for me is I know they're going to spend money to make something work," the manager says. But Larry Ellison's friendship with President Donald Trump, which could grease the wheels of a theoretical Paramount takeover of Warner Brothers, making a deal happen more smoothly and quickly than it would be for the other buyers, also gives many in the liberal town of Hollywood pause. "The Trump affiliations, I think, make everyone really nervous," the Warner Brothers insider says. All 3 bidders would gain Warner Brothers' massive IP library, which includes popular franchises like Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings, as well as DC superheroes like Batman and Superman. Netflix is a streaming giant that has shaken up the industry in numerous ways, but the acquisition of Warner Brothers would allow the company to gain the sort of legacy IP it's never had before. "If Netflix ends up with that much IP, I think it's devastating," the studio executive says, noting their belief that the repercussions could go far beyond just the DC franchise. What does it do to Marvel if DC's on Netflix? It's been reported that Netflix's bid includes an assurance that the company would continue to release Warner Brothers movies theatrically. That could be the best outcome for Warner Brothers Motion Picture Group co-chairs Michael DeLuca and Pamela Abdi, who recently renewed their deal at the studio, allowing them to keep their jobs and to keep the studio intact as Netflix's new theatrical arm. If it was Netflix saying, "We were wrong, we're going to do theatrical," that would probably be my favorite choice because at least they're acquiring something that they don't have, the producer says. But it's hard to believe that Netflix, a company that has built its entire model on being a disruptor and has long refused to do traditional theatrical releases, would suddenly change its tune. That's like streaming kind of having a hostile takeover of the theatrical business, and I don't buy it when they say, "We're still going to release movies theatrically," the agent says. He adds that Netflix's purchase of the studio would mark a much more significant shift for the Hollywood ecosystem than would be the merger of 2 legacy media companies. "I think it would be the biggest change in our business since I don't know when, maybe when the conglomerates took over the studios versus when they were privately owned." The potential Comcast takeover seems like the deal that would be most similar to the one reached when Disney bought Fox's entertainment business. Comcast and Warner Brothers Discovery have already had some crossover business, like the Harry Potter rides at Universal Studios, as well as the Olympics, whose broadcast rights are shared by NBC and Warner Brothers. Warner's 128 million global streaming subscribers would likely give stagnant Comcast streaming service Peacock an instant boost. But on the film studio side, it still feels detrimental, the Warner Brothers insider says. It still makes people nervous because it feels like a lot of people, certainly on the studio side, would be gone. Nervous is an understatement. For the filmmakers, producers, and agents who both make movies and attempt to sell them, the loss of another major buyer in the theatrical space is only has downsides. It's already so hard to sell a movie, harder than it's ever been, another agent says. With one less buyer on the market, there'll be far fewer stories able to reach audiences. Perhaps, though, there's a silver lining to all of this. The exec suggests that the shrinking of legacy studios may mean more opportunities for other players like Black Bear or Mubi to step up and try to release more commercial films. A24 has already been attempting a similar trick with recent releases like Warfare and Materialists. Whatever the outcome, it might arrive quickly. Yesterday, it was reported that Warner Brothers has asked the bidders to submit improved offers by December 1st. Sources say that Warner Brothers Discovery hopes to announce the winner of its multi-billion dollar bake-off as soon as mid-December. We're checking in on the royals now. Meghan Markle's dreaming of a beige Christmas. In the run-up to her Netflix holiday special, the Duchess of Sussex still embraces her signature neutral aesthetic. This is by Aaron Vanderhoof on November 24th. Ralph Lauren Christmas, a term for the multicolored, maximalist, and cozy visuals that take over the windows at the brand's Manhattan flagship store every year, is trending on TikTok. But over in Montecito, Meghan Markle is rebooting her signature beige aesthetic for the holidays. Earlier this month, Meghan released the holiday collection for her As Ever brand, and though the products contain some wintry flavors, including a cider mulling spice kit and sage-infused honey, they were all clad in the brand's signature beige packing. The Duchess of Sussex is wearing similarly neutral shades in a new video of holiday hosting tips coming out just in time for Thanksgiving, including a step-by-step setup for a parfait buffet. In the clip, she fearlessly transfers raspberry jam from an as-ever jar into a vintage serving dish without getting a single spot on her cream-colored gap separates. "You don't need to stress to impress," the video's Instagram caption reads. In other recent ads for the company, she's been hanging ornaments in another neutral-toned outfit, an olive-colored silk blouse and skirt from Argent. Meghan pairs the look with a Cartier Justin Clout necklace worth about $18,700 that she's been wearing since 2023, and her familiar Cartier Love bracelet. In other ads for the holiday collection, she's wearing the same necklace along with a burgundy Heidi Merrick dress, which the Daily Mail implies was a strike at critics who had pronounced her usual garb boring. The Duchess isn't just jumping on the beige trend, she seems fully committed to the beige lifestyle. Her commitments to neutrals also seem to signal that Meghan hopes her gift sets can continue to sell beyond the holiday season. A new release for her As Ever sparkling wine notes that this product is also the perfect choice for a graduation party. In a recent cover story for Harper's Bazaar, the Duchess spoke about her relationship with Prince Harry, saying that no one in the world loves me more than him. In accompanying photos, Meghan is dressed in black and cream, with one bright red dress tossed in for good measure. The Duchess also told writer Caitlin Greenridge that Harry's joyful personality has inspired her work over the last few years. "Harry has this childlike wonder and playfulness. I was so drawn to that, and he brought that out in me," she said. "That's translated into every part of our life, even in business. I want us to play and have fun and explore and be creative." The couple's professional output takes on mainly shades of neutral, so we might just have to take Meghan's word for it when it comes to Harry's sense of awe. Perhaps we'll see a bit of that playfulness with her With Love, Meghan holiday special, which premieres on Netflix December 3rd. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you are listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We are currently reading from vanityfair.com, and we are checking in on the royals. Our next headline: King Charles wants Princesses Beatrice and Eugenie to take on royal duties, says a source. "The sisters are sticking together," says family friends, "as the king hopes to limit their suffering in the face of their father's scandal." This is by Katie Nicholl on November 24th. King Charles is considering using Princess Beatrice and Princess Eugenie, the daughters of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor and Sarah Ferguson, for occasional royal duties in what is being seen as a public showing of support for the princesses, well-placed sources tell Vanity Fair. It was something that was being looked at before the recent events, but despite what has happened with Andrew, it's not off the cards, a royal source said. Whatever people might think of Andrew, the girls are kind, hardworking, and want to help if they can. Just last week, it was announced that Princess Eugenie, 35, is working with the King's Foundation as a mentor. At a mentoring reception for under 35-year-olds in London on November 13th, Eugenie appeared thrilled to be in attendance. She was so excited to be there and seemed very proud to have been asked, according to one source at the reception. It was fantastic to spend more time with the 35 under 35, who are such an incredible group of talented young people. I've enjoyed getting to know them better and hearing about their work and aspirations, and look forward to supporting their journeys into the future. Eugenie, who works as a director for Hauser and Wirth, said in a statement, "My career has been shaped by a passion for the arts, so it's a pleasure to be working with the King's Foundation to support this inspirational group of artists and creatives." Meanwhile, Princess Beatrice, who works as Vice President of Strategic Partnerships at tech company Affinity, was announced as Deputy Patron of the Outward Bound Trust, a charity focused on outdoor education, after having previously served as a trustee. Late last month, King Charles revoked his brother's titles, honors, and style, His Royal Highness, or HRH being used, following the fallout of Andrew's association with Jeffrey Epstein. According to sources close to King Charles, the monarch is fond of his nieces and doesn't want them to suffer because of their father's downfall. There was no deal struck about the future for Beatrice and Eugenie. They are private individuals in that respect, but there have been talks for some time about using them when and if there is a need. For their part, they have let it be known that they are more than willing to do public duties if and when they can to support the king. The source added that King Charles is testing the water to see how well his nieces are received by the public. In the past, the princesses have attended royal garden parties as ambassadors for the family and other overseas events, even though they receive no public money. According to a source close to the princesses, Beatrice and Eugenie recognize there is a responsibility to support their uncle, and they want to support him. Family friends say it's been a devastating time for the York family, but that Beatrice and Eugenie were determined to stick together and stay strong. Earlier this month, the sisters were photographed embracing each other in London. We are moving into the politics section. This first headline, Scouts Dishonor. Pete Hegseth, no Boy Scout, reportedly wants to put the boy back in Scouts. The Department of Defense won't comment to Vanity Fair on the possibly leaked pre-decisional documents, which would push Congress to cut ties with Scouting America. This is by Casey Wickman on November 25th. Remember the good old days when men were men and scouts were boys? U.S. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth apparently does, and believes that, in fact, the sun set on those golden days in 2018, when the organization, then known as Boy Scouts of America, amended its rules to allow girls to join. Things got darker still on February 5th, 2025, when the entity officially changed its name to Scouting America. Hegseth is now reportedly prepared to order the government to cut all ties with the organization, ending a relationship that dates back more than a century. NPR reported Tuesday that the outlet had received drafts of memos Hegseth intends to send to Congress, mandating a severing of ties with Scouting America. Hegseth, who never participated in Boy Scouts, wrote in the draft that the organization now serves to attack boy-friendly spaces, accusing the group of being genderless and promoting gender confusion. The organization, once endorsed by President Theodore Roosevelt, no longer supports the future of American boys, Hegseth reportedly wrote in the memo. According to the Scouting America website, the mission of Scouting America is to prepare young people to make ethical and moral choices over their lifetimes by instilling in them the values of the Scout oath and law. Hegseth, however, reportedly believes that the group's mission is to cultivate masculine values, per one memo, and that they are failing at it. When contacted by Vanity Fair for comment, an official from the Department of Defense said, "The department will not comment on leaked documents that we cannot authenticate and that may be pre-decisional. Representatives for Scouting America did not immediately respond to Vanity Fair's request for further comment. The about-face comes amid attempts by the Trump administration to quash many diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. In 2020, Scouting America added a new requirement for scouts working to achieve the group's highest rank, Eagle Scout, a diversity, equity, and inclusion badge, later renamed the Citizenship in Society badge. Though the Scouts have never been formally integrated with the U.S. government or military, they've had a somewhat symbiotic relationship with the foundations of the Scouting program drawing on military handbooks, and Scouting providing opportunities for military recruiting. The armed forces also provide medical and logistical aid, as well as demonstrations at the National Jamboree, a quadrennial scouting event that sees some 20,000 scouts flocking to West Virginia in the years it's held. Additionally, military bases often have affiliated scout troops, an association that would be banned under Hegseth's reported orders. Eagle Scouts have also enjoyed higher pay and rank in the U.S. military, and a not insignificant number of Scouts join up. According to the group's own numbers, some 20% of this year's U.S. Air Force Academy graduates had been members of Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts. Scouting America released a statement about the memos on Tuesday, attributed to CEO Roger Krone, saying he was surprised and deeply saddened by this news. "Our nation's military has walked side by side with Scouts for generations," Krone said in a statement. "An enormous percentage of those in our military academies are Scouts and Eagle Scouts. Our Scouts and leaders admire and are inspired by our military heroes. Many of our Scouts trade Scouting uniforms for the uniforms of our nation's armed forces." The suggestion that Scouts is no longer a meritocracy, as one of Hegseth's memos reportedly states, is clearly uninformed, he continued. "Badges and ranks are not given, they are earned. Just ask any Eagle Scout. Young men and young women alike thriving in Scouting. Scouts wear an American flag on their sleeve and swear a duty to God and country," the statement says. "Scouting isn't something we do, it's something we are." This is not the first call from conservatives to disavow the group in recent years. Heritage Foundation president and Project 2025 architect Kevin Roberts wrote in his 2024 book, Dawn's Early Light, Taking Back Washington to Save America, that American institutions, such as the Scouts, should be the target of a long-controlled burn to demolish rot in the country. "There's plenty of fuel," he wrote. "Like deadwood in a forest, many of America's institutions have been completely hollowed out. Decadent and rootless, these institutions serve only as shelter for our corrupt elite. Meanwhile, they block out the light and suck up the nutrients necessary for new American institutions to grow. For America to flourish again, they don't need to be reformed. They need to be burned." Our next politics headline, exit stage right. It's not just MTG. Other Republicans in Congress are reportedly eyeing an exit. Why? According to one GOP House representative, this entire White House team has treated all members like garbage. This is by Eric Lutz on November 24th. Marjorie Taylor Greene's announcement that she would resign from Congress in the coming weeks was a warning sign for the GOP. The Georgia representative arrived on Capitol Hill as the face of a Republican Party that Donald Trump had reshaped in his own image. But now, after a high-profile spat with the president, she will leave in January as the embodiment of that party's dysfunction. And she's unlikely to be the only GOP lawmaker headed for the exit. As Punchbowl News' Jake Sherman reported Monday, several other House Republicans are considering leaving their post in the middle of the current term over frustrations with the Trump White House and Speaker Mike Johnson. "This entire White House team has treated all members like garbage," a senior GOP member messaged Punchbowl, "and Mike Johnson has let it happen because he wanted it to happen." The arrogance of this White House team is off-putting to members who are run roughshod and threatened, the member added, saying that Republican lawmakers have little hope of maintaining the House majority they held on to in 2024. They predicted more high-profile resignations and that Johnson would lose his gavel. Morale has never been lower. It's a far cry from where Republicans were this time last year. In 2024, they were coming off a resounding electoral victory. They took the White House, retained control of the House of Representatives, and won back the Senate, and believed they had been given a mandate to radically remake America, as Trump claimed after defeating Kamala Harris. But they quickly abused that so-called mandate, with Trump authorizing Elon Musk to take a chainsaw to the federal government, forcing through his unpopular Big Beautiful Bill, and pursuing an aggressive tariff regime that has exacerbated the economic precarity he told voters he would remedy. The public frustration with Trump has intensified further in recent months amid his administration's brutal immigrant crackdown, a historic shutdown, and his handling of the Epstein files, the latter of which was a catalyst for the rupture between Trump and Green. Congress, meanwhile, has been mostly sidelined, as Green lamented in a lengthy statement announcing her resignation, which will be effective January 5th. Johnson has outsourced much of his chamber's legislative duties to the White House, which is unilaterally pushing tariffs, conducting strikes on what it claims are drug boats in the Caribbean, and even replacing the East Wing with an ostentatious ballroom. The bulk of Johnson's job, as he is currently performing it, appears to be standing in front of reporters and saying that he didn't hear about the latest Trump scandal. This year of chaos, cowardice, and corruption culminated in off-year elections earlier this month that could foreshadow a 2026 blue wave. Democrats dominated in races across the country, including in high-profile contests in Virginia and New Jersey, where moderates Abigail Spanberger and Mikey Sherrill won gubernatorial elections, as well as in New York City, where Democratic Socialist Zohran Mamdani was elected to succeed Eric Adams as mayor. Even Trump acknowledged afterward, "I don't think it was good for Republicans." It's understandable why some Republicans might be frustrated with the position he and the sycophantic Johnson have put them in, but any lawmakers who are considering following Green's lead might want to look in the mirror before they leave the House and ask themselves what exactly they expected to happen when they cast their lot with Trump. In 2024, Democrats learned the hard way about the pitfalls of making opposition to Trump the core of their political identity. Perhaps Republicans, 10 years into this loathsome MAGA era, will finally be made to understand the danger of basing their entire political identity around supporting him. Our next headline, a letter from Moscow. Russia's Gen Z uprising might accomplish what the West can't. A new generation of dissident artists is inspiring a wave of solidarity against Putin's war, recalling the Soviet people who ultimately defeated the Soviet Union. This is by Mikhail Zeiger on November 24th. The most talked about story in Russia right now is the handful of young street musicians who recently escaped from the country after being targeted for daring to sing protest songs. It began in St. Petersburg with 18-year-old Diana Loganova, who performs under the name Naoko. Her videos, covers of anti-war songs by banned Russian artists that she performed on Nevsky Prospect, have gone viral in recent months, and then she was arrested. On October 15th, she was sentenced to 13 days in jail for an administrative offense. On October 28th, she was re-arrested on the spot and sentenced to another 13 days. And on November 11th, she was again arrested without ever being released and sentenced to 13 more days, a tactic known as carousel arrests. Her lawyers believed at the time that a criminal case might be opened against her. Alexander Orlov, the group's guitarist, was also arrested 3 times, just like Loganova. Vladislav Leontiev, the drummer, was released after serving 2 consecutive jail terms. In the police van, Orlov, the band's guitarist, proposed to Loganova. He made a ring out of a napkin and offered it in an empty e-cigarette box. The couples told journalists about it before their court hearing on October 29th. The story instantly went viral, the fleeting moment of tenderness amid fear and humiliation, with millions following online as if it were a fairy tale from another, freer world. On November 24th, after serving three consecutive jail terms, Loganova and Orlov left Russia in haste and, according to their lawyers, are now safe. Their arrest and subsequent escape has ignited a wave of solidarity. Across Russia, young buskers have taken to the streets to perform songs in support of Loganova and Orlov. Some have reportedly also faced arrests. Despite the suffocating atmosphere of repression, this new underground movement reveals something unmistakable. Young Russians do not support Vladimir Putin's war on Ukraine. Today, we have almost no reliable data about what people living in Russia truly think about the war, about Putin, or about their own country. In a climate of fear, polling the public has become meaningless. Consider the latest survey published on September 30th by the Levada Center, Russia's only independent polling agency, branded a foreign agent by the government in 2016. The poll asked a simple question across various fields: how proud are Russians of Russia? The results are bizarre, and even more so when compared to data from the last 30 years. 78% say they're very proud of Russia's history, a record high. In 1996, only 41% felt that way. 64% now express a lot of pride in Russia's sporting achievements, a paradox since Russian athletes were banned from nearly all international competitions following the country's invasion of Ukraine. And when they do compete, it's as neutral athletes. So they're proud, or pretend to be proud, of something that has become theoretical. In 2012, when Russians were still competing in events like the Olympics under the Russian flag, only 29% said they were proud. 35% say they are very proud of the state of Russian economy, five times higher than in 2012 when the economy was objectively stronger. And most astonishing of all, a record 24% claim to be very proud of the state of democracy in Russia. In 1996, when there were still free elections, that number was just 3%. There's only one way to read this data. Russians are lying out of fear. They tell pollsters the opposite of what they really think because they know what could happen if they told the truth. This phenomenon is hardly new. In the Soviet Union, it even had a name: inner emigration. The atmosphere in Russia today increasingly resembles that of late Soviet years, when art and music became the last refuge for protest. Late Soviet citizens no longer believed in state propaganda. They felt trapped, convinced that life was a dead end. So they pretended the state didn't exist, that they could ignore it completely and live small private lives of their own. That's why they call it inner emigration. Unable to leave the Soviet Union, they withdraw into themselves, creating imaginary worlds to which only close friends were admitted. That illusion of non-participation became the essence of Soviet survival. Yet it was precisely these Soviet people, not Western intelligence agencies, not NATO, not any mythical foreign plot, who eventually brought down the communist empire. Even today, none of this inner life is visible from the outside. To the West, Russia still appears monolithic, united behind Putin's war, but that perception of the region is not new. The West once saw the Soviet Union in the same way: a gray, unified empire of obedience. In reality, it was not. The country had been hollowed out on the inside, but that's where its people were quietly creating another hidden world. In 1984, an American named Joanna Stingray came to Leningrad and stumbled upon a vast underground rock scene. Beneath the Soviet facade of slogans and parades, there was another city, alive, defiant, and full of guitars, tape recorders, and forbidden songs. People who seemed passive were, in fact, building a secret republic of freedom. A couple of years later, she produced the first officially released album featuring underground Russian musicians. The record Red Wave also came out in the West, sparking a cultural revolution in Russia that brought rock musicians out of the shadows. Now, history is repeating itself. Today's Russia, again, tries to appear solid and unanimous, but beneath its dead surface, a new unofficial life is emerging. Street singers, poets, comedians, and artists like Naoko from St. Petersburg. This new underground has no ideology, no manifesto. It's not political in the usual sense. It's simply human. Its only demand is the right to stay alive, to speak in one's own voice. Naoko's arrest has triggered an explosion of outrage on Russian TikTok and a wave of small but visible protests across the country. Solitary pickets, street concerts, and handmade posters taped to walls in every major city. More and more musicians are being detained for performing unauthorized songs in support of Naoko and her fellow Stop Time members. It's far too early to call this a Gen Z revolution, but their activism is proof that young Russians are not brainwashed. They do not support the war. They do not support Putin. This new underground culture, one that few people even realize exists. In 2022, after its army invaded Ukraine, Russia experienced a mass exodus of its most active citizens. Thousands of journalists, scholars, artists, musicians, and comedians, many of the country's best-known public voices, fled. According to reports, between 800,000 and 1.3 million people left during 2022 alone. The most popular Russian rock and rap artists now live abroad, where they continue to release new music. Within Russia, it's precisely this exiled culture that's the most relevant. For the nation's youth, the real Russia now lives outside the country's borders. Those who rule Russia today are the last Soviet generation. They grew up during stagnation, when everything was already decided and every door was closed. They believed their lives were a dead end, that they would never achieve anything because the older generation clung to power and refused to let it go. They never believed in communism, but they learned cynicism early. Now that they finally seized power, they are determined never to relinquish it. More than that, they're obsessed with avoiding their predecessors' mistakes. They wage war not only on dissidents, but on ordinary people who live in a state of inner emigration. They remember what destroyed their grandfather's empire. Not Western pressure, not dissidents, but the Russian people themselves, who one day decided they simply wanted freedom, wanted music, wanted to live. They were the ones who played protest songs on their guitars. Viktor Tsoi, Boris Gebenchikov, the same underground stars whom Joanna Stingray met in 1984. They were not overtly political, yet their music created the emotional climate that nurtured a freer and more defiant generation of Soviet citizens. This is why today's rulers are not only at war with their opponents, but with freedom itself, with that inner dependence that once doomed the Soviet Union. They're fighting not only against enemies abroad, but against life inside their own country. Oppression cannot be overturned from the outside. The West cannot defeat Putinism. Only Russian society can do that, just as the Soviet people once defeated the Soviet Union by ceasing to believe in it. But the West can still help. Similar to during the Cold War, the West can help those brave Russians who challenge tyranny. In the 1970s and 1980s, the West fought for dissidents' freedom, exchanged them for Soviet spies, and made their names known. Today, there are new dissidents. Some are dying in prison, being punished not for their actions, but for their words, even for their social media posts. Among them, the 17-year-old student Arseny Turbin, who has already spent 2 years behind bars. The street saxophonist from Samara, Alexei Shabanov, the 69-year-old Moscow doctor, Nezdeha Boyanova, the theater director, Zenya Berkovich, and the playwright, Svetlana Petrichuk. I'm deeply afraid that the 18-year-old singer, Naoko, and her fellow musicians may soon join their ranks. At the very least, the West must know about them, must remember their names, must fight for their freedom, no less than it fights for hostages taken elsewhere in the world. Because these people are hostages too, and the history of how the Soviet people once defeated the Soviet Union proves that such heroes must never be forgotten. Because when remembered, new ones will always rise to follow their example. Our last article today: RFK Jr.'s cousin, Tatiana Schlossberg, calls out his cuts to cancer research in a devastating essay. Writing in The New Yorker, Tatiana Schlossberg, the granddaughter of JFK, describes her struggle with terminal leukemia. This is by Eve Beatty on November 23rd. Environmental journalist Tatiana Schlossberg, the daughter of Caroline Kennedy, announced in an essay published Saturday that she's been living with a terminal form of acute myeloid leukemia. She was diagnosed at age 34 after a routine blood draw performed following the May 2024 birth of her daughter revealed unusual results. Writing for The New Yorker, she says that in the months since, she's undergone chemotherapy, a bone marrow transplant, stem cell treatment, and a clinical trial for a new form of immunotherapy. Many of these the results of federally supported cancer research, which her second cousin, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., slashed following his confirmation earlier this year. As Vanity Fair and others have reported, RFK Jr. lost the support of his family as he campaigned against vaccines and for president last year. As Joe Hagan reported for Vanity Fair in 2024, his siblings were furious and heartbroken over his candidacy. Following the presidential election, his sister Caroline, who has long shied away from public discussion of family members, penned a damning letter to the Senate opposing his confirmation as the head of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. According to a paper published last week in the JAMA, Internal Medicine Journal, RFK Jr. oversaw funding cuts to the National Institutes of Health that shut down nearly one out of every 30 clinical trials currently underway, many involving cancer treatments. In his role as HHS head, RFK Jr. has also expressed interest in firing the entire United States Preventive Services Task Force, a panel that advocates for cancer screenings, for being too woke, reports ABC News. And perhaps most significantly, the longtime vaccine critic announced in August that all mRNA vaccine development would cease, even though they are widely believed to be the next frontier in eradicating a multitude of chronic and fatal diseases, including cancer. In an August op-ed for the Utah News-Dispatch, cancer survivor and physician Brian Monick took Robert Kennedy Jr. to task, saying he is slamming the door on the survival chances of millions of cancer victims. One of those people, Natalie Phelps, tells CBS News that her participation in a clinical trial for treatment of stage 4 metastatic colorectal cancer has been delayed due to the cuts. "I have endured so much, and now I have another hurdle just because of funding cuts," Phelps says. "When is cancer political?" It's not just cancer that's become politicized under Kennedy. The HHS head has also opposed the use of antidepressants, falsely claiming that their use has been linked to school shootings. He fired all the members of the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices in June, and last week he told the New York Times that he personally instructed the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to abandon its longstanding position that vaccines do not cause autism, infuriating doctors, including Republican Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy, who voted to confirm RFK Jr. as HHS head only after Kennedy said he would not remove language from the CDC website debunking the disproven link between vaccinations and the disorder. Meanwhile, he's continued to publicly misrepresent chronic disease rates in the U.S. and oversaw mass firings at the FDA of experts tasked with the regulation of food and drug companies. Tatiana Schlossberg viewed all this with mounting terror as Kennedy's presidential campaign, which she describes as an embarrassment to me and the rest of my immediate family, made way for Kennedy's endorsement of Donald Trump for president and his eventual role at HHS. "I watched from my hospital bed as Bobby, in the face of logic and common sense, was confirmed for the position, despite never having worked in medicine, public health, or the government," she writes. Schlossberg didn't directly address her brother, Jack Schlossberg's recently announced congressional campaign, but she does note Jack's vocal opposition to RFK Jr., writing, "My brother had been speaking out against his lies for months." She also notes the time and attention Jack has devoted to her care, writing, "My parents and my brother and sister too have been raising my children and sitting in my various hospital rooms almost every day for the last year and a half." All forms of treatment exhausted, Schlossberg writes that her remaining time with her children is crowding out most other concerns, including those in the political realm. "I try to fill my brain with memories," she writes, "of watching her son and daughter play. Sometimes I trick myself into thinking I'll remember this forever. I'll remember this when I'm dead." This brings us to the end of our time here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, and my name is Amy Smith, your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thank you so much for tuning in. I invite you to join me next week. We'll have another full hour of stories from vanityfair.com. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great week, everybody.